relevant for the joint theme, but also are especially helpful. Are especially helpful for the concept of Kedushin Bechlal. So there are some points which really do contribute to our understanding just of the opening sugyas and Kedushin, how Kedushin works and the like, that are going to be interwoven with this topic. So I think for all those reasons, it's an appropriate topic to spend some time on. It's also appropriate because there are people getting married throughout this week, who people in this room know. So let's say, for example, today or any day over the course of this week could be Yom Chupaso of somebody in our immediate circle, and there is a practice to fast on the day of the wedding. That's what the Rama quotes, that there has developed a minig like that, that on the day of one's chuppah, one should fast. The minig seems to be predominantly a Ashkenazi minig. That's how Rav Avraham Yosef writes to his Shuvas, that this is not a minig that has taken place in Sephardi culture. A few other localities which may or may not have this practice, but it's a practice that is widespread enough, at least within Ashkenazic circles, that it is brought down in the Ramah. So the question is why? Why should you fast on your wedding day? So the Maramint has a few suggestions, and the Maramint could be well known on his own, but in particular in this context is well known because he's quoted on the side of the page by the Beis Shmuel. And in Arachayim, where this comes up, Magen Avraham quotes it. So then Nosei Kelim on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch quote the Maramint as theorizing as to what this is about. So one of the possibilities, the one that's most relevant to us right now, is the idea that there is a mechila for the chasen, that the chasen gets a kaparas avonos on this day, and apparently, somehow that means he should fast. So somehow is a big question, which we'll come to in a second, but that it starts from this idea that there is a mechilas avonos. And this idea, perhaps most prominently, is Rashi and the end of Parshas Toldos, if I'm not mistaken, where Rashi highlights the fact that Esav's wife has different names in different places in the Torah, the same wife, whether she's called Basmas or called Machalas. And Rashi explains that really she is Basmas, that's really the name. But the idea of Machalas is there to convey this notion that a chassan who gets married gets a mechila, which is really based on a Yerushalmi in Bikurim. Okay, so let's say we accept this idea that the chassan indeed gets a mechila sa'avonos. And the question, like Jonah was asking before during Seder, and it's an important point to think about. So, okay, maybe we could accept such an idea. This might theoretically be comparable to other places where you find such a thing. A person is Olul Gedula, Parnes, who's appointed over the Tzibor. We find a couple of characters who are apparently given a mechila, who get forgiven for their averos. Is it always the case that we expect them to fast? And whether it is or isn't, why should one lead to the other? You would say that if I'm getting a kaparas avonos, adarabba, I should party. In fact, most people do have parties on their wedding day, but that comes later, right? So why do we say that one means the other, that having a kapara means you should fast? Could have said the opposite. Okay, you get out of jail free card. Let's celebrate. Why is one lead to the other? So this prompts another question. So what do we mean when we say that there is a mechila? Right? What question could you ask here, which maybe is prompted by the fasting question? You see what is the underlying question that could be asked here? To fully define the sentence of a chasen gets a kapara, what does that mean? Okay, so presumably he did, because Ein Tzadik Baretz, if he asked lo tov lo yechta. Also, a lot of chassanim nowadays are human. So chances are good he probably did sin. But let's assume that's the case. But how do we understand that sense, he gets the kapara? So what you're seeing here by this question of fasting is that there are potential different interpretations of the sentence.
Hesed. That maybe means that it's a time like that it's easier for him to get a
kapara. Excellent, right? So the question, are we saying there's an automatic kapara? In which case, party? Or are we saying, no, it's not there's an automatic kapara. Saying that it is a time when a kapara is particularly available. And therefore, you should take steps to take advantage of it. So that seems to be the question here. How do you understand this? That automatically? And here again, you could ask, is this, what's the story by other things? What's the story by Parnas and Ismana El Asibur? What's the story by Gershon Iskayer? What's the story by some other context where you find this kapara? Is this the same? Is it different? And if so, what's the story there? Is this automatic or no? It's not automatic. We're saying that here's a good opportunity. So now take on a very serious approach so that you can actualize this opportunity, and maybe that's where the tainus comes from. So that's a big question. And again, the question is a legitimate one because the idea of fasting is not explicitly brought up in these earlier sources. The idea of fasting is the later minute. So we're only theorizing, the Maharam Inz is theorizing, and others are quoting this theory that there's any connection between the fast and the kapara. We don't necessarily have to say that based on the earlier sources, so it's kind of an open question based on the earlier sources, what exactly is going on. So here is another major Kiddushin connection that if you had a chance to see this morning in the Maharam Kamos, so the Gemara later on in Mesachus Kiddushin has a passage. This passage is probably, I would say, one of the top three or four Gemaras that gets quoted during Elul. It's got a lot of implications to it, and it happens to be a Kiddushin reference, so it's important we should bring it onto the table as early as possible in Elul. But definitely, you know, if you've listened during past Eluls, this Gemara gets quoted somewhere. The Gemara says that Ha'omer Leisha Hareyat Mekudeshesli Almanas Shani Tzadik. If somebody says to an Isha, I'm going to marry you on the condition that I am a tzaddik, that's the tonight. So then, what's the din? It works or doesn't work? Suffolk Mekudeshes. Right? I mean, the halacha, Pashas Mekudeshes, because he's going to have a get, because we're worried that at least it's a suffolk. Now, do we make any investigation first as to what kind of person this is? Sigmar says no, that even if we know this guy is the worst guy in the neighborhood, even if this guy is established as a Rasha, still, we are still going to assume a policy of Suffolk Mekudeshes. Even if he's not the kind of guy anybody would have thought is a tzaddik. So why is that? So here the Gemara says, Shama hirher b'tshuva. Maybe he had thoughts of tshuva. So maybe he's a tzaddik. Now the reason this Gemara gets quoted so often in Elul is not because everyone's holding in Kiddushin Sugyos, but because that last line is really what makes people most interested. Right? The idea that the tshuva process could be so quick, right, that somebody could be known as a scoundrel, and that perhaps there was an invisible process that happened in the 5 seconds since you were aware of that, and when he said, Hareya Mekudeshes Yamanash Shani Tzadik, that's really what gets a lot of attention at Elul time, and it's certainly very striking. And maybe that we can come back to at various times over the next few weeks. For example, Rav Kook, in his classic work on Tshuva, Arus HaTshuva, sort of Rav Kook starts off with a statement about how you find Tshuva is very mysterious because it's both the easiest and the hardest mitzvah, potentially. It's the hardest mitzvah for reasons that we could easily understand. But beyond its inherent challenge, it's also very hard because whoever knows when he has fulfilled it. Again, this is a topic which I think we'll pay more attention to in a different context. But on the flip side, this Gemara makes it sound like it's very easy, right? Or that it could happen very instantaneously, and there could be a complete reversal between a person who's known to be a Rasha and all of a sudden the status of Tzadik Gomer, that at least we have to worry that might be true and that the Kedushin might be good. So for that reason, the Gemara gets a lot of attention. Hi.
But isn't just like thinking to yourself, like, I'm going to do tshuva, that's like the beginning of a process of tshuva. So how does that,
Exactly. Right. So that's a big question. So where one comes to the other, how you all of a sudden get that. Again, there's so much material there for our purposes, so I think we'll keep that for a future discussion. But now what we'll zero in on is a question that some of the Achronim ask. Happens to be a big discussion about this in a Sefer called Kezvas Yotzer. It's another one of the expanding genre of Svarim that are written on the Parsha and Halacha and things like that. So remember, he has an essay about this, about is there possibly a contradiction between the ideas that we've seen in the past few minutes? Right? If we say that a chassan gets mechilas avonos, so then maybe we should say that not only is this Gemara maybe not so surprising, maybe it's not enough. What are we saying? It's a safek, shema hirhir b'tshuva. Let's say it's a vadai. Let's say, okay, he's a chassan, so for sure he's going to have mechilas avonos, so boom, it's a vadai kedusha. By the way, parenthetically, and this also makes things a little more interesting, the question of whether it's automatic or whether it's potential or the like, so that also brings up the question of where did we get this whole idea from originally in Rashi and Chumash? From Esav. So how does Esav fit into this whole picture? Are we assuming Esav is considered to be a tzaddik? Does it make a difference who you marry? Does it make a difference? There's a lot of questions here that just come from that source. But leaving that aside for a moment, so this is a question some discuss. So if a chassan automatically gets mechilas avonos, so then, yeah, vad is a tzaddik. Now, you could say that, well, no, it's all circular, right? That only the kedushin only works if he is a tzaddik. So if he's not a tzaddik, then he's not, kedushin won't work, and he won't get mechilas avonos. And therefore, maybe the question is not such a strong one, and I hear such an approach, but still we have sometimes a concept you find elsewhere in halacha of kind of zev v'zev bo'en kechad, that you could have the Kedushin Bichal and the Mechilas Avonis coming at once. So let's assume that we're not bothered by the circularity of it. Let's assume that he is a Chassan. This is an act of Kedushin. So why is it not enough?
Hi. Well, can't we just say that's probably Rezir Shami, as we can do normally?
Okay. Yeah, but that's not such an exciting answer.
Right, but it would indicate that there isn't necessarily this Indian according to Bobby.
Maybe. Or there could be more we could do with it. In general, the answer is like that, with all due respect to this. Because, so, yes, it's certainly possible for the Bosnian and the Yerushalmi to disagree. I think we were talking the other day about how Tosafot can disagree also with each other. But we usually go for that as a second to last resort. The last resort is Tosafot. I'm going to change the gear so that's the real last resort. Right? You really can't find anything else to say. Second to last resort, but we in general like to assume that, especially from Kippur, we want to minimize machlokas. Right? So we want to try to keep things as harmonious as possible. So we try to go to machlokas as a second to last resort. So is there a way to assume that these are consistent ideas, especially because it's not only Rishalmi. We find it in Midrashim. We find it as a general attitude. Again, Rashi quoting it. We find this general idea of there being a mechila. So I like to assume it's probably more than just that location. So how else could you approach this issue? Any other thoughts? Well, there are at least two distinctions you could make just to keep this front and center. So one place we have a source saying this man performing Kedushin with this K'nai is only Safek married. And on the other hand, we have the idea that a Chassan gets a Kapara. So, what differences could we find to sustain both possibilities? Jen?
Maybe once the Tshuva Me'aba, once Tshuva
Me'aba. Ah, okay. So that's actually, I was going to get to that second, but let's use that first. That there is such a discussion. That how do we know that the language really matches up? Right. So the Chassan gets a Kapara, and the case in Kedushin, he says Tzadik Gomer. So does kapara equal tzadik gomer? Maybe not. Right? Maybe kapara just means, okay, you have a clean slate. But he didn't say, Hare at mekudeshes li amanas shani innocent, amanas shani beinvi, and amanas shani neutral. He said tzadik gomer. So maybe there's a space there. That's how some svarim suggest. that yes, indeed, he would get a kapara, but that's not enough to reach the level of Tzadik Gomer. So what would be enough to get to Tzadik Gomer? So it could be that maybe, like Jed is suggesting, maybe in Yitshuva Me'ahava. And so then maybe if Yitshuva Me'ahava was the case, so maybe that would be enough. So that's, and that gets into an interesting discussion, which I think we'll have to make time, maybe on a Sunday coming up, maybe to talk about Yitshuva Me'ahava in general, what exactly it means, but it's a mysterious concept by itself. But for now, we know really one thing about Yitshuva Me'ahava. I think it was on the Makaris for today, that the Gemara says, at the end of Masechet Yoma, that we have two levels of tshuva. That tshuva meyira, that brings you to zero status. That makes all your averus like accidents. The donos nasim lo ke shkagos. While tshuva meyava, that's better. That makes your averus into mitzvos. So nachanami, maybe if this guy did tshuva meyava, okay, so then that would be a status of definite tzaddik. Now, that tells you a couple of interesting things, right? It tells you kapara doesn't necessarily get you there. Kapara, that he would have, but that would just put him into neutral status. But maybe he did do tshuva me'av. So that statement is basically saying that the hirhur tshuva could have reached the level of tshuva me'av, which is a pretty powerful statement. So in other words, if this is the theory we'll use, so then we'll say that the chassan just get the automatic chassan p'tur, like they have for Bechinas here in Smicha, a story of at least one person who arranged his engagement and wedding around Smicha Bechinas that were subject to the Chasim Petor. So Chasim Petor gets you out of some things. So it gets you out of your Averis also. It's an even better deal. So the Chasim Petor, as we'll call it, so maybe that only works to drop the Averis, but the Tzadik Gomer, that was the condition that he made, that would have needed Tshuva Me'ava. And that could have happened. That's why it's a Suffolk Kedushin. So maybe this here tshuva could have constituted the tshuva me'ava, but that we don't know. So that's one possible approach. Another possible approach, which discussed the Chavis Yotzer, mentions this based on Tikkun HaPrima Gadim, that this is also highly relevant to something we've been talking about already in our introductory phase, that maybe there's another distinction we could make. What other possible distinction could we make? Think about this for a moment. Tarei Mekudeshesli, maybe that doesn't have the,
Is it the stage of marriage?
Oh, okay, yes. Excellent. So maybe that's possible also. Right? So maybe what it means is that when does this kapara come? The kapara comes with Nisuin. The kapara comes with the full marriage. But we know that Kiddushin comes first. Ideally, right? So you're saying Hareyat Mekudeshesli. So maybe Mekudeshes by itself, that does not bring the Kapara. The Kapara would only come later with a full Nisuin. So that's an interesting possibility as well, and that maybe prompts the next question. All right, so let's assume that there is a Kapara, and we see now something about the nature of the kapara. The kapara maybe is just a neutralizer. Maybe it's more, we don't know. Maybe it only comes with nisuin. Maybe it's not something that's automatic with just kiddushin. And we're still not sure whether it's automatic or not, or whether it requires a process which would explain the whole idea of fasting. So all of those questions are still somewhat open. But let's keep those in mind as we ask another question. So conceptually, why should it be true? Why should it be the case that a chassan should get any kind of mechila? It's a wedding present, and he gets enough presents. What else is, what gets out of bechinas, and how much more do you want? So what is the explanation of why there should be a kapara? How would you understand it? Is it a wedding present? What's the idea?
Because he comes up in the Gemara with the Chatan, Chacham, and Nasi, it's like he's someone who's like distinguished and a leader, and therefore it's like he's being watched more. He'll be more careful with the Averos, or perhaps like a self-esteem thing.
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting spin on that. That's not the common spin, but it's interesting. So you're saying we could note something from the fact that it's compared to people who rise to a new level of prominence. I think I would have thought responsibility. But you were highlighting here that, okay, they're putting themselves in a context where they're going to be more careful. So, okay, that's very interesting. If so, so fine, so good. He'll be more comfortable, more careful from here on in. So why should he get a kapara for that? Hi.
I had a different idea.
Okay.
Maybe because when you get married, your wife is your connecto, and mm-hmm. so you're becoming more shalim in who you are. And so it's a new opportunity for you as this new person to be able to start doing mitzvot. And so you have like a clean slate because now you're able to serve Hashem in the best way that you possibly can.
Okay, you said I take a couple of things in that sense, and they're all relevant. So one thing you said is that you're taking on new opportunities for mitzvos. So that's relevant. That's definitely something which maybe we should say, okay, because we'll trade, because you are rising to a level where mitzvos are going to be more successfully accomplished. So then that should give you a pardon on some of your or all of your previous mistakes. There's another idea contained in what you said also, or I guess in both cases I thought maybe you were going in a different direction, although you ended up saying different interesting things. What else can you maybe glean from here? What else might be the key idea?
Different status.
Different status. Okay, so what about what does a different status do for you?
I mean, we have paradigms of the fact that, like, a Kohen Gadol, when he's a little bit doula, he's a pastor on Karbanos to happen in the past. So what does it do for you? I guess you're a different person.
Different person. Okay. So the Maral actually writes that before marriage, no offense to the single people in the room, a person is a half a person. It's a pla gufa. And therefore, once they get married, so then they become complete. And therefore, now they're a different person. So maybe that's what creates a kapara. You know, tshuva, the Rambam, Hilchos Tshuva, often describes a person who's done tshuva as a bria chadasha, as a different person. So it goes both ways. So you become somebody new. So then perhaps that itself is a form of tshuva. That itself is a kapara. So that's one model that you find. So it could be that you become a new person. Could also be that Ksav Sofer writes that a little similar to what Jed said, maybe different, that maybe putting yourself in a position where you are likely to do better in the future is enough reason to give a kapara for the past. So the Ksav Sofer notes the Gemara in Yevamos that a person who's married is like somebody who has a wall, the idea being it's a protection against the Eitz Hara. So maybe a person, by committing to a marriage, is making a statement that, okay, he's now going to protect himself more from the Eitz Hara, and therefore, that's a statement that should earn credit for whatever past mistakes there were, at least now, and this is also a very Elul idea, right, that if we take on more protected environments, or take on a context where we're more protective of our spiritual status, then whatever happened in the past, we should get forgiven for it because we're renewing our commitment in a stronger way. So that's also a concept that you find. Then together, there are those who simply attach it to a mitzvah concept, which is similar a little bit to what Noah says, that since this is a mitzvah, this is the Ratzon Hashem, so therefore that's something that should get you credit too. Apparently, you could say, okay, but every mitzvah is a mitzvah, okay, mathematically speaking. So how do we decide that this mitzvah is different? This mitzvah brings the kapara that we don't associate with other mitzvahs. Simply, you have to say it's simply the mitzvah so much more encompassing. Or in some of the svarim, they say that because it connects to Yishuv HaOlam, the settlement of the world, this is a much bigger idea. And therefore, Kapara comes along with that. I've heard Rav Shechter many times that engagement parties and similar contexts talk about somebody's been learning and how whatever they've accomplished until now is one thing, but once they're married, and as you pointed out, is a connecto, so it's possible for them to accomplish so much more. This is a favorite theme of his for contexts of marriage. So we do have such an idea that you're setting up for yourself a situation where you're going to be more spiritually protected, more spiritually productive, more accomplished, and therefore maybe for all those reasons there could be justification to say that we should give you a new slate and that we shouldn't hold you responsible for whatever has happened in the past. Question?
Yeah, maybe also like the idea that, like, you know, you don't want to have your children sort of be punished for the actions that you did, and sort of if marriage is sort of this way to, you know,
to protect your children.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating idea.
So you wouldn't want to come into a marriage already being, you know, discredited from the thing
for their sake.
Before. Yeah.
That's a fascinating idea. It's a really interesting concept. And you can think about it from a couple of ways. We say that it's a schus the future children have that they, because we don't want them to pay the price, that we should start to slate over now. You could also say, maybe, just thinking about Zalad, and you brought it up, that maybe whatever notion there is that the children are part of it, so to whatever extent we understand how that's fair, okay, it's one thing if somebody does the Avera knowing the kids are part of the picture, so then there's what to talk about. But just because it was part of a parent's past, maybe that's not even something we can see at all as a system that we can relate to, and therefore maybe, again, the Mela we have to kind of start over. It's an interesting thought.
I was thinking similarly to Keith, but instead of the children for the wife, then she's now entering a new relationship, and now it should be fair to her to start off with a clean start.
Okay, I mean, why should she be tied down to somebody who has this? They're interesting ideas. Okay, so let's recap the past few seconds. So what reasons do we see? We see either that you become a new person, like the Maharal emphasized, or that you are creating a setting for yourself where you will be more protected, more careful, like the Ksav Sofer's idea of the Choma, or like Jed's idea of being in the public eye, or that you are going to, with this act itself is a mitzvah, or a particularly powerful mitzvah of Yishuva Olam, or what's been suggested in the past few minutes, that now there are more people involved, and therefore, out of fairness to them, maybe that's why you should be able to kind of restart things. All very interesting ideas. Okay, so all of this is part of the background to this question of why this kapara should exist. Hi.
Does this also apply to the kavod or just the chasad?
Oh, that's a huge question. Huge question, right? So we'll get to that, God willing. Hopefully we should be on schedule to get to that. Okay, so, oh, that's very interesting. So, again, with this background, but still it's hard to decide conclusively from any of this whether it means it's automatic or whether it means it's an opportunity. Maybe even all these scholars really just tell us that, okay, your acts of tshuva right now will be more easily accepted because tzirif, you know, that tshuva with these things maybe is something that's going to be more successful. So I don't know if any of these svaras help us understand that question. So really what we have to work with is more just the Minig Yisrael, the Minig Ashkenaz at least, to treat it as a day of tshuva and not as a day of automatic kapara. And that seems to be the practice that, again, whether you fast or not, but fasting a widespread practice among Ashkenaz Jewry, and to daven mincha with the vidui and the like, other practices of tshuva seem to also be connected to this. Hi.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the fasting for the chatan on his wedding day,
mm-hmm.
Is just like in general when the Rambam talks about fasting as a call to tshuva. So
right, so that seems to be the idea, that if this is the notion that the kapara of the chasan is why we do it, so then it seems to be because fasting is about tshuva. But then we have to say together that it's not automatic, but that if we chose to make this a moment of tshuva, it's a moment when we'll be more likely to be successful. And maybe also with all the svaras that were said here, maybe also the points that the two of you made also about the family members, maybe that could be flipped and say that, listen, you, chasan, you're about to bring other people into the picture, so whatever attitude you had before now we have to take on a more responsible approach and do tshuva, and it'll be readily accepted, and start over from here on in. Okay, so that does, all of this contributes to the background of what we have, that there is an attitude that we treat the day of the wedding like a personal Yom Kippur, like a Yom Kippur that addresses the individual. So that's all within one theory of the Maariv's. There's another theory of the Maariv's also. Right? There's another approach. What else is, what's his other approach? This is, by the way, hugely relevant to our sugya. So this is major synergy here, because this this topic is really very applicable to the beginning of Kiddushin. The stuff we'll hopefully also discuss this coming week. What's the other approach Maariv's has? So we're worried that we shouldn't have shichur. So we're worried that they shouldn't be drunk at the time of Kiddushin. So therefore we say, stay away from eating completely so that you shouldn't get out of control and become intoxicated. Now you might say, okay, listen, there's a big jump from one to the other. If I don't want to be drunk, so why do I have to fast? You know, how do we assume that eating anything is a straight path to intoxication? It's a fair, right, that's the question. Why should we say that if we're trying to avoid drunkenness, that therefore we have to fast completely? You would think that, especially because you find, for example, that there are other areas of halacha where we're concerned about drunkenness, like a kohen in the Beis HaMikdash, or like a posek when he's paskening. So there we say that there is a concern about drinking, but we don't say that it means they should fast. You know, with a nazir, we have a somewhat expanded prohibition at other wine-like foods, but we don't say automatically. So there is a shuvas called, a sefer shuvas called Chalkas Asada. It was written by Blazer Deutsch, who was a dying in Hungary about 200 years ago. If you want to read over there, he has a whole explanation of how one leads to the other, why it is that if we're really worried about drunkenness, why should we go so far as to abstain from all eating. You find this also in the context of Erev Yom Kippur, that the vidoy should be done before the meal. Before the meal that you have before Yom Kippur, the assumption again being that you're going to get drunk. So here, there's what to discuss. So there's some svarim that write that certain moments that are higher in spirituality, the Eitz Hara is greater, and the likelihood of drunkenness, intoxication is even more. Whatever, however you understand it, there is this idea that maybe if we want to avoid drunkenness, we should avoid eating completely. So that, how step one leads to step two, is what to talk about. But what's of greater interest to us here, again, for those of us here learning the first sugya in Kiddushin and the introduction, we're still holding an introduction to the first Mishnah in Kiddushin. So what else is interesting to explore here from this statement? What questions might come to forefront? No?
Being a tzaddik is not a quantitative, I guess, thing to be makdish a woman with.
Okay, so right. So going back to that Gemara, right? That is still what to try to figure out in the ambiguity. But here, just talking about this last idea that in light of trying to understand the first sugya in Kedushin, this statement that the fast is to avoid intoxication at that moment is interesting to us. Why? Okay, so say more. So more than one word.
In other words, that there needs to be some kind, there's that we're acquiring, we said, with das, and then it's just kind of a megala of the das, or gilui of the das, and therefore this is showing how important the das is in the opinion.
Okay, so that's why this is really very relevant to our sugya. Just because it raises the question without really answering it, but it raises the question, what exactly are we worried about? So let's say he is drunk. Let's say she's drunk. Let's say they're both drunk. Does it matter? So what if they're drunk? Right, so what's not clear here, but what needs to be explored, and therefore is very relevant to our opening sugi of Kiddushin about the Kenyan Kiddushin, is does it affect the Kenyan? Is it somehow a lack of das? Is that what we're worried about? Does it affect equally both the chasen and the kala? Right, you saw the round in the Durham last week that there's not so much that's really required of the kala at that point. So should we distinguish between the chasen and the kala for this purpose? Is it that really we're not worried it's going to do anything, but we're worried it'll just cast doubt? That's how some svarim say. That later on, You know, they'll say, what do you want from us? It was Las Vegas, and we got drunk and went to a chapel, and I don't really know who she is. Right? So we worried that if there was intoxication at that time, then later on there'll be a claim the whole thing was a mistake. So is that the concern? So it's not clear. So assuming somehow eating is connected to intoxication, taking that for granted, why are we so worried about intoxication at that time that we're going to go so far? It's not 100% clear why, but the question is very, very relevant to understanding what goes on in the process of Kiddushin. So that's something to keep in mind in the course of this week when we get more into that. What does Kiddushin require of the Chasen? What does it require of the Kala? And to what extent would being intoxicated possibly affect that and call that into question? But in any event, so that is possibility number two in the Maamarim. There is another possibility which is associated with the Rokeach. The Rokeach already is one of the Rishonim. It's a German Rishon and a gefilte fish brand, but first it was a Rishon. So the Rokeach has an idea which you have to assume is not totally literal, but in general, part of why I like the Sugya, by the way, and a few other Sugyas like this is, and this is something which is kedai to be sensitive to, is that what we're dealing here, we're talking about today, is really a minig, right? So it's not a din in the Gemara itself. It's not a minig that exists in all of Klal Yisrael, as we said in the first few minutes, but it's a minig. And part of what you see through this discussion is that minhagim are not random, very far from random. And the reason that we take minhagim so seriously in Jewish tradition and law is because we assume that there is a chachma to Klal Yisrael in the way minhagim are developed, and therefore it's worth very careful attention. So this is one of the examples of that, and that's why I think it's always worthwhile to see discussions like this, because you see that when there is a practice among the Jewish people, there's an assumption that it has meaning to it, and there is a great effort to try to figure out how the development takes place, what exactly it connects to. And then the fact that, as we'll see in the next few minutes, that there are halachic ramifications to the understanding is also very significant, because you could say, all right, I have to keep a minig, but whatever it is, a minig is whatever it is, nothing to think about. And you see, that's not the attitude of posting. The attitude is that a minig is basically a sugya. And a minig is as if it was a gemara, as if there was a din explicit somewhere. The same way, if we saw a gemara say you should do this, we would try to figure out why is it this, is it that, curious, showing, and have a whole discussion. So too, we assume that minhagim are deserving of the same kind of approach. Even though they're not sugyas in the Gemara, they are the way things have developed, possibly even only among a segment of Klal Yisrael. But either way, it requires seriousness of approach in trying to figure out how it should develop. And occasionally it will happen that we'll look at a practice, not this one, but other practices, and we won't be able to find any reason for it. And then those are the kind of hugim that don't get upheld. So not everything that was done necessarily continues. But the idea of a minig is that we're very careful and respectful to try to figure out, is there a halachic tradition behind it? And if so, to try to make sure that that is upheld and enhanced. And if not, then that's possibly not a genuine minig, and those types of practices fall away. But what's also part of the discussion here is we understand that a minig, by the fact that it's not in the Gemara or in the Torah, so we understand that a minig is not going to have a direct source. That when the sources that we talk about are going to be values, that when we find a value in the earlier sources and then we recognize that a minig is there to uphold that value, so then that's when the minig gets its foundation. Follow what I'm saying? So it doesn't mean that you expect a minig to directly correlate to whatever you might find in Shas, because then it would be a din drabanan or it would be a din minatorah. The idea of a minig is that it's not going to correlate directly, it's going to share the same value system. So here's an example of this. The Rokeach writes that he thinks that perhaps the idea here is that we know that Rosh Hashanah is coming up, so we have a mitzvah of Tkiyah Shofar, and we're not supposed to eat before Tkiyah Shofar. And we know that a few weeks later, Sukkot is coming up, in the midst of taking lulav and esrog, and we're not supposed to eat before lulav and esrog. So this notion that we have in general, that when you have a mitzvah in front of us, so you don't eat beforehand, so theoretically that could translate into this as well, that the day you have the chuppah in front of you, you shouldn't eat beforehand. Now, as I was indicating a minute ago, you could have all kinds of quibbles with whether or not this is comparable. Right? The shofar and lulav have a set time. It has to be done during that time. Eating then would risk pushing it off. Maybe Kiddushin is not really comparable. You're setting the time in the first place. It could be later in the day, earlier in the day. There's all kinds of differences. But again, that's the point. That I don't think the Rokeach is saying that, oh, Alpidin, the same concept that you find by shofar and lulav, Alpidin applies to the wedding also. But he's saying, conceptually, that the same attitude that tells us that we don't want to eat when we have this mitzvah in front of us to perform, so too, that attitude leads to a minig that we're not going to eat on the day of the wedding. Hi.
Is it also problematic that you said that the Ramah said that you drink the kosher bracha like during the chuppah, so you are breaking that fast kind of before the actual nisuin occurred?
I don't know if that's really problematic, because that's, you know, at the moment. So, and it's integrated into the process. So I think, like, if that was a part somehow of shofar or lulav, no one would be called a chilo or a shesia shel mitzvah. So I don't think that would necessarily really have to bother us. Hi.
Two things. First of all, the Rokeach assumes that it's a mitzvah, right?
Right.
Meaning that's kind of the law behind it. But if one doesn't assume that, then it would be...
It's also a part of it. Although you have to say, you know, at least it's a mitzvah kiyumis, but right. But you're probably right also, but if it's not a chiyuv, then still it seems different. So it seems to be working off that assumption.
And secondly, I think I remember in the Aruch HaShulchan, he was the one who said that it seems to be more of the second reason, because we don't wait till Tzitzis Kochavim per se. We just break the fast right away, like people have afternoon weddings and they eat right afterwards.
So let's get to that question. Okay. So that's the next. So here, among the nafkaminas, so to speak, so let's try in the time we have to discuss a few nafkaminas of these understandings, a few ways in which this would affect the practice, in keeping of what we said a minute ago, that even with minhagim, we don't just say, well, whatever it is, but we try to figure out how the logic behind them will lead to a consistent practice. So the first question that Jonah is bringing up is, what about weddings at various times of the day? So let's say, for example, we'll start with this. What if the wedding is a daytime wedding? What if the wedding happens in the, let's say, early afternoon or even earlier? So should the fast continue after the wedding is over? So this would seem probably to correlate to the various reasons that we've seen. And how so? How would it correlate to the reasons? Somebody help me out.
According to the Rokeach, you wouldn't need to continue because it's...
mitzvah's over, right? And especially, let's say, according to the more well-known two reasons in the Maariv Mintz, how would it line up?
Well, the drunk, right? Then you're fine, you did the kitzur, so
you're... Okay, so once you've made it through the chuppah sober,
yeah.
Right, then that should be okay. And what about the other way? So it seems it should what? Should keep fasting?
Yeah.
Right. So that's what it would seem, logically speaking. It sounds like if that's the issue, that if it's like the Rokeach or that the idea we're worried about intoxication, then there doesn't seem to be any logic to fasting past when the chuppah takes place. If it's about a personal Yom Kippur, then it's a little harder to explain why you should stop then. Presumably you need a full day fast. So that's gonna conflict a little bit with actual practice, because I don't think you're going to find anyone, as much as this Yom Kippur idea is a widespread notion, I don't think you're going to find in practice too many people who would, you know, continue the fast after the chuppah if the chuppah was earlier in the day. I don't think that's really such a prevalent practice. Hi.
can you just say that once the Shas and Mechilas Avonis is over, then you can start eating and drinking, because that's as if Yom Kippur is over.
Right, is there a way? So I did see one sefer that said that you know, that we don't necessarily have to see the Tainus as a full day Tainus like you see at other places, but that it could be a Tainus of this new day that's defined by the beginning of the day until the Chuppah, which, you know, is kind of a hybrid, but perhaps it's possible to say. It does say in Svarim, by the way, that even though normally, and I'll discuss this more in a few minutes, the practice is if somebody gets married on a day when you're not supposed to fast, so then they don't fast that day. But if it's only going to be a partial fast anyway, because the chuppah is in the middle of the day, so then that shouldn't get in the way, and then maybe one should treat it like any other day and fast until the chuppah, and only break their fast after the chuppah, because they'll still be fulfilling the idea of eating on whatever day it is. So that would seem to be a nafka mina of this whole story. And that, if that's the case, so it seems like Klal Yisrael has taken the approach to break the fast then no matter what, which will have to square with the idea that the Yom Kippur notion is a prevalent, popular notion, but still that seems to be the practice. Kiva.
Maybe you could say sort of like the Tainus B'Chorus, and the day does qualify as a fast day, but the wedding, like sort of circular, the wedding itself eliminates the fast day.
That's another creative idea. You got a couple creative ideas today. You're saying that, oh, your fast is going on, but it's suspended by the Seudas Mitzvah.
Right.
Anything until now wasn't a Seudas Mitzvah, you would have just been eating. But once you get to the Chas, it's actually an interesting idea. Okay, you just score two interesting ideas today. You keep in track. Okay, I like that one. Could be. It's only the Seudas Mitzvah that always like it. Okay, not bad. I could explain Hanhaga. So that's one side of the equation. What about the other side of the equation? What if the Chuppah is after dark? Right, so should you keep on fasting until after the Chuppah? So here it's where I think John was referring to Aruch HaShulchan, right? Aruch HaShulchan took the view that, yeah, you should keep going until you've successfully carried off this Chuppah because of our concern of intoxication or whatever. While others took a different attitude, Ephraim Greenblatt, the Rebbe Ephraim, passed away a little while ago, was a student of Moshe Feinstein. So he records in his Chuvas that when he got married, Moshe was present, and I guess the chuppah took place sometime after dark, so at the tish, he said that Moshe encouraged him to have some cake, to eat a little bit, and he said that you were ready yotze the fast, and the fast was already over, because it's already dark, so now eat something. So this would seem to be a nafka mina of this approach. Again, that if it's about having a fast for kapara, so the day should be enough, we shouldn't require more than the day going into the next day. But if it's about intoxication, so then we should have to hold off until the chuppah is actually over. And especially if you say like the rokeach, which I think some sfarim point out, all the more so that the closer you get to the mitzvah itself, the more there's going to be an iser achila. So even if you could have been more makel about the breakfast, but now in the immediate zone preceding the chuppah, we would say with greater intensity that you shouldn't be eating them. Hi.
Would the rokeach allow, you know, like morning, you know, tea breakfast though?
So you could argue, again, I don't know explicitly, you can't ask him, but maybe like a filter fish, but or soap, right? I don't think, but the logic seems to say that the focus would be more the time immediately close to the chuppah. So there's another question you could ask based on this. If you think it through, right, to say that you should only have to fast until dark and then you should be able to eat then. So that highlights something a little bit noteworthy here, too. Right? Yes, sir?
It's not, if you're saying the day before, that's not really the day of your wedding.
Right. So then you make the point, if you're saying the day is over, taka, maybe you should start the fast then, right? Maybe the fast is on the wrong day then. Halachically, it's not Yom Chupaso, if that's your whole point. So I think this highlights something else. This was spelled out in one sefer, the Shuvah Sefraim Elazar points this out, but I think this highlights something else. So the way he explains it especially if you say that this is an idea of tshuva, of actualizing the potential for kapara by doing tshuva, so then maybe there's no such idea, right? We still weren't totally on firm footing understanding how kapara leads to fasting. So all the more so, we don't necessarily know that it has to actually be the day of the wedding. Maybe what we're being told here is that if you have this opportunity for tshuva, this opportunity for kapara coming up, you want to be on as solid spiritual footing as you can be. So therefore, you should do a tainus for tshuva in close proximity. But maybe it doesn't have to be the day. So if that's the case, so then, all right, you fasted the whole day. Your wedding is Thursday night. You fast the whole day Thursday. Thursday night's already Friday. It's a different day. It doesn't matter. So based on that kind of understanding, so I have an approach which is different from everyone else. So I will acknowledge that it's totally idiosyncratic and that Klal Yisrael does not follow this, but this is what I advocate to anybody who asks me, and this is what I did myself in my own personal situation, is that we said a minute ago that the practice is that if somebody gets married in Rosh Chodesh or whatever, one of the days when we don't fast, so then they don't have the fast. But we think, based on what we're seeing here, that what you should do is just push the fast up. That find the closest day to the wedding that is acceptable to fast on, and fast then. Because whatever value comes from this tshuva should take place, even if it can't be the actual day of the wedding. So, again, b'didi ha'avda, so I got married on Chanukah, which was a Sunday. So I fasted the previous Thursday. You couldn't fast on Shabbos, you couldn't fast on Friday. The previous Thursday, that was when I had to fast. Because, okay, so it's not the day of, but it still is mekayim this idea of having a tainus of tshuva in proximity to the wedding in order to actualize the tshuva idea. Also has advantages that people who are sometimes worried about trying to be fully present at their wedding while fasting, so or having just fasted, so if you make the fast a day or two earlier, so then that helps. And sometimes I also advocate that for people who feel they're just not going to be able to function at their wedding if they're fasting. So I think this is an eight as well. But again, it's not the widespread practice. The widespread practice is people in this situation to skip it, and at least the youngster situation to skip it. But I think this is a valid approach. Hi.
Based on this, is there any aspect of specifically doing it on the day? So let's say you get married on a day where you could fast. Can you still fast the day before?
So you want it apparently to be as close as possible, but if there's a reason not to do it that day, so then, you know, so in the case we started off here where it's after Shkia, so you get the best of both worlds because you get a full day fast, which, you know, has a clearer spiritual significance. It's in very close proximity to the wedding, and you also don't have to go in plotzing because you had a few bites before. So one could say that's the best situation. In general, if somebody, for whatever reason, can't fast on that day, either because of halachic reasons or because of health reasons or whatever else, so then to push it off a little bit, there's a svara to it. But I think either way, you want it to be in as close proximity as possible, so usually that'll end up being the day of. Okay, so this is one possible nafkamina, the timing of the chuppah. Another possible nafkamina, I'll give you a little bit of an introduction before mentioning what it is. So, there was a great tzaddik, I believe Yitzchak of Berdichev, who wrote a sefer called Kedushas Levi. And in the Kedushas Levi, he has a fascinating point. But he was attacked for it. And I think we have to defend him. Because if you know anything about Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, so he was known for always defending Klal Yisrael. He always stood up for us. So we owe him a favor. So we have to defend him also. So I'm going to try to suggest a defense for the shita that he had that was criticized. In Parshas Chayisara. So we read about Eliezer, who goes to discover Rivka, our great-great-grandmother. And the Torah tells us that he's offered food by her family. And he says, I'm not going to eat until I say what I have to say. So So how come he didn't eat? Says Reb Levi Yitzchak Abreditra, the reason he didn't eat is because he was fasting. Why? Because he was a shliach l'kedushin. Now, parenthetically, there's a whole discussion in Chayisar. Again, this is a favorite topic of the Parsha Halachas Varm. But there's a major question: what was Eliezer's mission? Was Eliezer a shadchan or a shliach l'kedushin? Was it his job to find the kala and bring her back, or was it his job to actually carry out the kedushin? Should we assume he was a shliach l'kedushin on behalf of Yitzchak? So there's a lot of discussion about that. Some interesting ramifications. So Reb Levi Yitzchak was assuming he was a shliach l'kedushin. He was performing kedushin at that point. So therefore, because there is a minig to fast, so that's what he was doing. He was fasting. Now, it's interesting. There is a whole discussion one could have about Eliezer. Eliezer technically was not Jewish. So whether Eliezer observed halacha is a whole discussion. Has
some, Torah.
Right. That's okay, fine. You want to be specific with the details. Right. So it comes up this week's parasha, because this week's parasha we're in the prohibition of Nechush, and the Gemara in Chulin sounds like it might be accusing Eliezer of Nechush. And then the whole discussion: was it Nechush? Was it not Nechush? So do we assume Eliezer was keeping this concept? So in any event, so here Levi Yitzchak, you see, not only assumes that Eliezer was adhering to halacha, but apparently adhering to Ashkenazi Menhagim as well. So, therefore, this minig to not to fast on the day of the wedding, so Eliezer was holding by this minig. So, okay, the fact that it's an Ashkenazi minig that's being attached to a non-Jewish Eved before Matan Torah, that's not why he's attacked. That's not why this is criticized. And that's not the point we're going to try to defend. There's another aspect. What else could you possibly use from the Sukkim surrounding the story to question his pshat? Rav Asher Weiss, for example, B'Mechilas Kavodah, has this attack in his sefer, although B'Mechilas Kavodah, I think we're going to try to answer it, but what else could you say? Yeah?
Can you not, meaning he's a shaliach for kedushin, but doesn't Yitzchak have to see her first?
Oh, that's a great question. Now, that's a question on the whole concept of shlichus to kedushin for... because the Gemara does say that it's a problem to use a shliach for somebody you've never met. So that's a fair question. That's a question on the whole idea that he was the shliach, which is a fair question. I want to be narrower, just specifically Rabbi Levi Yitzchak's idea that not only was he a shliach, but that he was fasting for that reason. That's where I want to address it, yeah?
He gave presents already to Rebbe, okay. So maybe that
would... Okay, happened already?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. But without the letter, because he still has what's still, it's clear that he hasn't yet,
Well, he hasn't convinced them, the parents, but...
Okay. Yeah, but presumably, it does sound like he's waiting for that. So,
what are those presents, then?
He's buttering her up. You know, that's a halachic question in general, you know.
That would be considered.
Right, but whatever that is, so let's assume the Kedushin hasn't happened yet.
She have Tana?
That's also a discussion.
So wouldn't it be based on that, whether she accepted or the parents?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, also true, but let me narrow the question a little more. Are there psukim in Chayei Sarah that call into question the premise that he was fasting?
Oh, he drank.
That's what they ask. He wasn't fasting, because we see that he drank water. That was how he figured it out in the first place. So that was why... this position of Levi Yitzchak is questioned. So I would like to take the opportunity to try to defend the grave of Levi Yitzchak as Hakar Satov for all his defending of us. And I think you can uphold his pshat as follows. First of all, the idea that he was a shliach l'kedushin. So does a shliach l'kedushin indeed fast? How do you know that it's really up to the shliach to fast also? What do you think? Is it so obvious to you that, even assuming we're all Ashkenazi, Menhagim, observant people, is that really the case, that a Shliach L'Kedushin should also fast? What do you think? Prima Gadim is a suffix about this. What should it depend on?
Depends on the two different reasons the Maharam is.
Okay, so explain.
Meaning, if it's just that it's a personal Yom Kippur, mm-hmm. or something along those lines, then obviously not the kiddushin. The
presumably not, right? The kapara is presumably associated with the chassan himself.
Right.
Even if the chassan is home in bed and this guy is doing it on his behalf, it's safe to assume that the kapara is associated with the chassan.
Right.
So, okay, so that's one
thing. Shikros. We want everyone to have das is involved, and therefore those two people would not be able to be there.
Okay, so very good. So, sounds like that's correct, right? That if the idea is that it's a kapara, so then the chassan, if in a situation where you have a shliach doing the kiddushin, as unideal as the Gemara in the second parak tells us that is, but in a situation where you have a shliach, so should he fast or not? Sounds like this is correct. That if it's about the kapara, then no, the chassan should fast, not the shliach. But if the idea is that we want the maisa to be untainted by intoxication, so then the shliach is the one who's relevant, and he should be the one fasting. So the whole discussion that Eliezer should be fasting or not is apparently only going according to the possibility that it's about intoxication. So now if you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, who works off that position, right? The Aruch HaShulchan we saw a few minutes ago said they should keep the fast going until the wedding actually happens, even after dark. So the Aruch HaShulchan also writes that because the concern is Shukras, if you're very weak, you can have light food and water. So it works out, right? That the whole side that Eliezer should be fasting on Shlichus the Kedushin would allow him to drink water, so it's possible to say that yes, he drank water, and still he's fasting, he's still avoiding any heavier meal, and hopefully we can bring some merit to the position of the great defender of Klal Yisrael. Okay, so that's as far as Shlichus the Kedushin. So let's try to squeeze in two more points before Mincha. So one other issue that's just brought up that's relevant to this time of year, coming up to this time of year, they also discuss in the Sfarim, the Matat Ephraim talks about this, and the Matat Ephraim is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. That's all Hilchos Elul and Tishrei. The whole volume is only on the Elul and Tishrei mitzvot. So what if somebody gets married between Yom Kippur and Sukkot? So should you observe the fast then? And the assumption is that maybe if we're trying to have a kapara, so maybe you could assume that Yom Kippur should already still have some impact. Because there is a Gemara, which maybe so is on the Mar Makomos at the end, I think. The Gemara increases. It says that Baba Ben Buta used to bring an Oshem Talui every day. Because who knows, maybe he did something. So he would make sure to bring an Oshem Talui every day. Except the day after Yom Kippur, they said, you know, give us a break already. That chances are that it's still a few hours after Yom Kippur, you probably still haven't broken your streak yet. But once it's already a day later, then okay. So some who connect that to this and say somebody gets married the day after Yom Kippur, so maybe we should assume there isn't a need for an additional kapar.
And there's a similar question with, like, when you say Hurachim after, for Mar,
yeah.
After.
So that's a lot to talk about what that Hurachim signifies. But you go so far as to fast on the day, to bring an Oshem Talui, it's a little bit more than Hurachim. So, in any event, that point is well taken. But you already exceeded your interesting thoughts of the day quotient. So you only get a point well taken for that one. So, just to mention one last point, which is mega complicated, but also very relevant to our sugya and kedushin, so it'll be a good segue back into the sugya for tomorrow and the rest of the week. Question of whether the kala fasts. So in the original sources that talk about this, in the Ramah and the Maran Mintz, it says chasen and kala, right? It says both of them fast. But despite the fact that that's what you find in the earlier sources, so in the later Sfarim, they kind of look at the issue fresh, because when, let's say, you have a situation where the Kala specifically says that she doesn't think she's healthy enough, she doesn't think she's strong enough to fast and have her wedding at the same day, the question could come from either side, but when the question is coming from the Kala, so the poskim who talk about this, again, I would advise one possibility is to have the fast earlier. And then the combination, if you have a full fast a few days before, and then on the day of, avoid heavy foods and intoxicating things to satisfy both possibilities. But just as part of the background, that when a kala comes and asks, I'm not sure if I can fast, so the poskim who talked about this readdressed the question, even though it seems to already be there in the earlier sources, but they readdressed the question, well, how much are we sure that the kala needs to fast in the first place? So this is very complicated, because let's think about it. So how would we decide this? Does the concept, does the logic behind the fast, does it apply to the kala? So just to indicate, I'm going to again say this quickly because Minchas in a few minutes, but I guess we could still daven up here also. But either way, daven up here. Yeah, maybe we will. But sorry. No, we don't. We're good. Okay. So yes. So in any event, so just to maybe we'll do that. So just to finish off this point, it's interesting how complicated it is. So what would you say? Let's try to think this through. So does the kala have the same level of connection to the fast as the chasen does? So you see, it's like a 10-step flowchart. Yes.
So
right.
If it's shichros, then
okay. So if it's shichros, to take that first. So then what?
Oh, well, then it depends if she needs das.
Right. Like, so this is if it's a good flowchart, right? So if it's about shichros, none of these are going to be a slam dunk, right?
Yeah.
If it's about shichros, then we have to figure out, okay, well, what's the issue with shichros? And does that apply equally to the chasen and kala? Is it that there won't be das? Well, then does the kala need das? Is it that we're not sure that we'll be able to even talk about consent? Like, the kala for sure needs consent. That we're going to talk about soon in that vase and the vase. If the issue is, we might worry about, I guess we'll call the Vegas problem, that they just got drunk and ran off to a chapel and somebody will call into question later. So then maybe that should apply to both of them. So if it's shichros, we have a whole discussion to have, which again we'll segue right back into our Gemaras this week. What exactly is required of both parties when the Kedushin happens? Okay, so that's one thing. What other paths do we have to explore? Well, we have two other theories, right? So,
if it's a kapara, is she?
Oh, so if it's a kapara, so then does the kala get a kapara? Well, that depends. What's the kapara for? So, you know, we have to then go through all of our various theories as to what brings about the kapara in order to figure out whether the logic of the kapara applies to the kala as well. What about the rokeach? Right, so.
Is it
a mitzvah? So is she involved in a mitzvah? So there again. So if you saw the Ran, which was on our Mar Mekomos last week, right, the Ran at the beginning of the second parak, and the Gemara says the chasen shouldn't use the shliach because mitzvah bo yosher mishlucho, and the kala also shouldn't use the shliach because mitzvah ba yosher mibishlucha. So the Ran says we mitzvah ba. There's no mitzvah in the first place. So then he says, well, maybe there is a mitzvah, because even though she's not obligated in Purvu, but mitzvahs misayaya, there still is. The fact that she's helping and she's a necessary component of it, so that still counts as a mitzvah. I didn't get a chance to mention in Shir, I think I discussed it with Jed, that we should get back to this in the context of Shir also. That Ran sounds like the only thing we care about is Purvu. But if you look in the Sefer HaMakna, who we mentioned on Thursday, the author of the Sefer HaFlah, Rabbi Shmuel of Nicholsburg, so in his Sefer on Kiddushin, the Sefer HaMakna, so he says over there on that round, he says it's not just about Peruvu, but it's about Kiddushin. Kiddushin is a mitzvah like we've been developing with the Rambam. It's a mitzvah just to sanctify the relationship, if there's going to be a relationship, separate and aside from the question of the children. And that mitzvah, at least on some level, should apply to the kala also. If the kala is interested in being a part of a relationship with a man, then she also has an obligation to be a part of the kedushin process. So basically, again, it's kind of a flowchart. So we have three different reasons. If it's A, there's a whole discussion. None of them are obvious. If it's A, there's a whole discussion to have whether it applies to the kala. If it's B, there's a whole discussion to have. If it's C, there's a whole discussion to have whether it applies to the kala. So la maskana, the attitude is, you know, again, especially since it's in the Ramban and Maimonides, that l'chachila, we certainly assume that the kala should fast. But if there's a reason not to, if there's a health concern or the like, so then there's a slight edge to be more makel with the kala than the chasen, because there's some room to question whether or not it applies. But none of those rooms to question are absolute, no matter what side you take. So it's not so powerful. So again, mechachila, we should say that they're really on the same status, and they should both fast. And again, I would say that if there is a health concern, so if it's possible to fast at all, so then one ideally should pick the closest day, which is not going to impact their health and not going to impact anything else, and fast then and let it carry out. Because just 11 in a second, just to quickly review what we spoke about. What we see, we saw the Ramah says this minig to fast. The question is why? The Maramin, quoted by the Magen Avraham, the Beis Shmuel, has a few reasons. So one reason is because there's a Mechilas Avonos, which Rashi and Chumash quotes, and the Yerushalmi says. So that prompts us with a couple questions. So question one is this Mechila automatic? In which case, why should you fast? Or is it something that's an opportunity? And then we could understand that fast to maximize the opportunity. Question two was the fascinating Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Mem Tes, that Hariyat Mekudesh Yisrael Menashe Nitzadik. So then that's a Safik Kiddushin. So the question is, if there's a Mechila Savono, so why is it only Safik? Why don't we say Vaday? So we saw a couple of approaches. Either that the Kapara is not enough to make you a Tzadik, you need Tshuva and probably Tshuva Me'ava to become a Tzadik, and that could have happened, but we don't know, but still the statement that here of a Tshuva might be enough for that is interesting. Or the possibility is that maybe it only works with Nisuin, and the Gemara is talking about Kiddushin, so if he had Nisuin, there'd be a Kapara Savonos, but just that Kiddushin should work off that premise, that's not going to be enough. And then we talked about the question of why is there a Kapara at all. We had a couple theories. The theory that you're taking on a more responsible status of living, so things will be better from here on in. You're taking on a wall of protection to protect from the Yitzhara. The question of the Maral, that you become a complete person. The idea that it's a mitzvah, it's a bigger mitzvah than other mitzvahs, so mitzvah al vishva olam. And some of you guys suggested also that maybe if we're going to involve a wife and children in the process now, then either you should be more responsible or we'll give you more of a break on the past in order to have a clean slate for the future. But these are all various theories of what the Kapara is. Then we talked about the possibility that this leads us either to a fast or to end as well to vidoy and things like that. And then we talked about another shita within the Maramins that maybe it's about avoiding shichras. And we said that's a very interesting point. We'll have to explore further. Why do we care about shichras? So who's das, Kenyan, what exactly is the concern? For some reason we're afraid of intoxication. How exactly that fits, we'll have to figure out. And then we talked about the third possibility, the rokeach, that is there, like the night eating before shofar lulav, you know, before the wedding either. And even though that's not a direct application, it's an example of how a minig can develop based on a underlying halachic value. When we talked about some nafkaminas, the question of if the wedding is in the middle of the day, that whether you should break the fast then or not. Most people would break the fast, so that's interesting to note, and whether there's a possible hybrid version of saying that it's a fast for kapara, but a fast that ends in the middle of the day, how exactly to address that, and then what if the fast goes, or if the chuppah is after the day is over, so the Aruch HaShulchan says to keep the fast going, but the others say differently, or Frank Greenblatt says that Moshe told him to break the fast at dark, and that prompted the question that really it's a different day, so why should we be fasting that day at all? And we noted here that maybe the notion really never was to fast on the day of the wedding, but to fast for a day in close proximity to the wedding, in which case, if your wedding is on a day when you don't fast, really this should be a possibility to keep the fast going, just do it a few days earlier. And then we talked also about the question of Shliach LeKedushin, or the Shliach LeKedushin fast, and that should be totally that if it's for a kapara, then it's the chasen should fast. If it's for das, not intoxication, then the shliach should fast. And then we use that to defend Levi Yitzchak, who said that Eliezer was fasting because he was a shliach l'kedushin, despite the fact that he drank water that day. So a shliach l'kedushin is only because you're avoiding shichrus. And the Aruch HaShulchan writes that if it's about avoiding shichrus, so then having water should be acceptable. And we talked about fasting during the days between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, and Baba Ben Buta and his Lashon Tole during that time. And then finally, the very complicated question of the Kala, that even though earlier sources say the Kala does fast, but there's been some discussion about it later, is it really applicable in the same way? So we saw that no path is going to be simple here, that if you say that it's because of the Kapara, so then you could ask, does the Kapara play equal to the Kala? And we've got to go through all the theories what the Kapara is about and figure out whether or not they are the same. If the idea is like the idea of the rokeach, that it's about not eating before mitzvahs, then we have to talk about whether she's a part of the mitzvah or not. And again, it's the ran, the sefer makna, and the like. And if the idea is that it's to avoid shichur, so then the very major question, which again we'll probably get to this week, the question of what kind of das does the kala need, what kind of das does the chasin need, to what extent are we worried about intoxication possibly interfering, is it the same kind of concern in both directions? So all of that will reconnect as well. All right, big yasher koach. Who's going to daven for us? We have a volunteer. Okay, Jeb, you look like you're very volunteer. All right, so let me face this way.